Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, a recipe for farming from a Leitrim mushroom farmer, anxiously scanning the skies in Wicklow, chipping off the old block in Tipperary, and surrounded by family in Cork. First day of March, first day of spring, actual spring, I mean, can you feel it? I know that if you're a druid or a committed pagan or a devotee of Bridget, you're under the impression that it's been spring for a month now. And you know what? If you believe that February is actually the start of spring, you are welcome to wear a t-shirt all month long. But for those of us who observe meteorological spring, can you feel the warmth this week? When the sun does shine and hits your back, it suggests all kinds of greenness and growth is not that far away. One of the really nice things about this programme, about getting into so many farmyards, apart from feeling the sun on your face this week, is to see how many people in recent years have found the time, the money, the energy to restore tumble-down farm buildings. Quite a few I have seen have received help from the Heritage Council in the form of this 75% grant to put things back to rights. So during the week, I visited some unique farm outbuildings outside Kerr, County Tipperary, owned by organic farmer Anke Owler, that had been conserved with the aid of one of those grants.
Oh, this is a good place to get a view, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the best you can kind of get.
It's a very unique little yard, isn't it?
Oh, it definitely is, yes. And it kind of also gives us an insight into how these old farmyards would have been used, with kind of shed for carts, a grain barn, the dairy behind the kind of maybe the farm manager's cottage.
Anke's farmyard buildings are chocolate box pretty, at least 150 years old, and definitely worth holding on to if at all possible.
Some loose boxes for horses, because a lot of course would have relied on horsepower back then.
And not in a courtyard shape, or typical courtyard shape, but laid out as an E shape.
Yes.
That is very unusual to my eyes.
Everybody has told me so.
Okay.
I grew up with it, so for me, that's just what it is.
Okay.
It's a gorgeous yard. I'm very fond of it.
What's really nice, and what you don't see a huge amount of in Ireland, is the grey limestone and then the architectural details around the doors and the windows in red brick. It's a vernacular it's not completely uncommon, but it is unusual, isn't it?
And very pleasing to the eye.
Very,
very nice.
Very, very pleasing.
And we've done up one, the longest building as such now, with help of the Heritage Farm Buildings Grant.
Yeah, and then the other one would be over there.
Up a ladder and into the roof space with conservation consultant Julia Gable.
And you can see here, this was really the worst section of the roof, where we had the valley rafter end was completely rotted, so it was freely hanging.
It turns out that the work done by Julia on the roof ahead of the winter just past might have averted complete disaster.
On this corner, which caused further deterioration on the wall plate and the valley boards as well.
How dangerous a place is that for you to work? Because if you have to remove all of these valley rafters, you essentially just have a freestanding wall that could topple over in the next big gust of wind.
Yeah, now I believe we caught it just in time. I think even the snow earlier this year could have caused the final bit of damage where the whole roof...
The weight of the snow sitting on it, yeah?
Yeah, where the roof could have caved in, because all the structural... most structural timbers were just not doing their job anymore.
Oh, you're making very short work of that.
It's a beautiful stone to work with. It's very homogeneous, that Irish blue limestone.
Julia is more than a conservation consultant. She is also an expert stonemason, most at home fashioning new architectural features to replace those lost to the weather.
So what I do now is I'll secure my edges with a
small flat chisel. It's like a tiny draft that goes right along the line and it preserves the stone where it don't want it to break. It gives it a fracture line.
It's kind of like a perforated edge. You can remove everything else at the waste space, yeah.
Exactly. The principle is very similar.
When you're doing this, can you empty your head of everything else and focus just on this, or are you working out your aggression?
Well, not with this fine work, I can't. But it is very meditative, and you have to focus on what you do. Whatever mistake you make can just ruin your whole day's work.
I'd imagine you have to be pretty philosophical, because the risk of losing everything that you have done with one single blow must be quite high.
Well, it's not only that, to be honest, and maybe I'm a bit of an overthinker in that regard. But it's also the awareness that whatever we do is going to be there for hopefully a couple of hundred years. So we leave definitely a mark in our built heritage that is not going to be erased.
Does that motivate you? Does that sustain you?
Yes, it gives me purpose, yeah, absolutely. And that was part of the reason why I started doing this job, because I was looking for this permanence and also for the secrets that this holds. I was working in Belvilly Castle or in any other tower house, and you can see the strokes of the chisels of the masons that would have been working on the stone 500-600 years ago. And as you can see here, every stroke is a split second. So every stroke is a split second in somebody else's life 500 years ago. It's fascinating, and it puts a perspective on life in general.
Do you feel quite a strong connection then to those people working a half a millennia ago doing exactly the same thing as you?
Without getting too philosophical now, our lifespan is so short and the continuity of our culture is so strong. No matter where you look on the globe, where you have stonework, you can see the chisel marks and you can see the strain and the hardship and the ingenuity that these people had, that we still have.
And in a world that is changing at a dizzyingly fast pace, it must be reassuring then to see something that is so unchanging.
To be honest, I think it reveals the opposite to what we're experiencing now, is this extreme fast change to our environment. But I think it reveals what humans are actually capable of with our hands, our creative instincts and our connection with nature and with our environment, that we are threatened to lose at the moment, because if we put ourselves into a digital context all the time and in a virtual reality, then we're losing this connection.
Conserving Anka's farmyard is about saving a group of outbuildings from 1870 and holding on to undervalued skills. But Yulia says it's also about preserving two other things that sometimes feel in short supply: authenticity and beauty.
We're going to lose these skills. And I've seen projects where laser cutters or CNC machines are used to carve more elaborate, and I understand that it's a cost factor, absolutely. But we need to find a balance in these things.
To your eye, it's not the same thing, but to me, to somebody untrained, will I notice
no.
the difference?
Yes, you do. When you see something that's handcrafted, there's invariably the character of the person, the character of the stone, the complexity of the form is multiple times more defined than when you cut it by a machine. And that is something we perceive, even if it's subconsciously, but we perceive it and we find it actually very pleasant. It's a very pleasant irregularity. We can relate to the materials better, to our environments better. Everything else is just sterile. It's machine-made. We cannot relate to it. And that is a distinct deficit that we build into our conservation practices nowadays.
What's it like owning and living in something like this? Is it a burden or is it an honour or a little bit of both?
Honest answer, it's a little bit of both. It is a huge honour and privilege to be, well, you know, our lives are relatively short in comparison to, you know, time. And it's kind of like a stewardship, you know, that you have when you own something like this. So during your lifetime, it is up to you how you want to spend your time, what you want to do with what is available to you and around you. And I have the privilege to have inherited this farm. My dream is that these buildings will be in better shape when it's my time to pass on the farm to my daughters.
Your dream, but also your responsibility.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, yes. And it feels very good to have started on that job now by having been granted the help from the Heritage Council to have a real go at repairing the roof.
Would you have been in a position to do that without the help of the Heritage Council?
Not in this form. It would have probably been more propping up for a good while and saving up, or just, you know, kind of doing
little bits at a time.
Little bits at a time and whatever, you know, whenever it just absolutely had to be done, kind of, yeah.
Anca Owler outside Kerr County Tip. If you believe you might have a building that would qualify for one of these Heritage Council grants, you have another 10 days to get an application in, heritagecouncil.ie for more details. In the course of the last few weeks, we have had the new Minister for Agriculture and the new EU Commissioner for Agriculture on the programme to both introduce themselves to you and to set out their stall for the next 5 years. So this morning we thought, for the sake of symmetry, we should hear from the main opposition party spokesperson on agriculture, Sinn Féin's Martin Kenny. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Philip. Delighted to be here.
Thank you for coming in. Now, coincidence would have it that I said to those two men, you don't need to be from a farming background to do your job, but it probably helps. And now I find myself saying the same thing to you.
Well, as it happens, I'm not farming at the moment. I grew up in a very much a rural agricultural community. When I was 19 years old, I went off and borrowed money and put up mushroom tunnels and grew mushrooms for many years, and worked in the Midlands and the West with Welsh mushrooms, also advising growers and working in horticulture. So I have a very acute knowledge of farming and of the issues that are there. My brother is farming, suckling cows, about 7 or 8 of them at the moment, and, you know, struggling to survive. And that's the way it is for most people in my part of the world.
I don't know an awful lot about mushroom farming, but what I do know, what I have heard from mushroom growers, is that it's, if you want to make money, it's get big or get out. Yeah. Well, was that what happened to you?
Well, that's it. You see, in the 80s and 90s, there was this programme which was absolutely brilliant for small farmers to innovate, to have something which was an additional income source on the farm. Some people had chicken houses, some people had mushroom tunnels, that type of enterprise. And there was grants available and there was assistance for that. And a lot of small farmers would have put up 3 or maybe went to 5 mushroom tunnels. It, I suppose, created a bit of employment in the local community as well, where there wasn't much, mainly women picking mushrooms.
But the market
changed.
The market
became
now
more
has
intense.
Forced people to specialise and to remove that diversification. Is that something that you think we should return to?
I think it's regretful that we have ended up in that position, because, as you say, you had to either get bigger or get out. So an awful lot of those growers, in fact, the vast majority of those growers that are still growing mushrooms have 25, 30 tunnels, and the smaller ones are gone and it has become a big business. There's, I suppose, that element of it, that it's, yes, there's the economics of it, and the economics, the scale has to be there to provide for that economics. But there's also the social, the environmental, the community, I suppose, element of having a small business in a local rural community, which is creating a bit of employment and keeping people going.
Let's turn to policy. I read all the policy documents, looked at the website, went back through your manifesto. Where is there any difference on agriculture policy between you and the government?
Well, I think it's about emphasis, and a big part of our emphasis would be about the family farm and ensuring that model can be maintained and made sustainable into the future. unfortunately, there has been a lot of effort going toward more and more intensification in agriculture. I think the model which will work best for us and will work best for Ireland if we can try and establish it is a model which is lower intensification and higher biodiversity value. And I think that there is an element of consumers out there across Europe and across the world that are prepared to pay a higher price for that. But that takes a lot of work to get there, and I absolutely understand that. But that will give the best return to farmers. Okay. Particularly those on smaller holdings.
That's the broad big picture, though. Let's get into the detail and find out where it is that you're actually in opposition to the government. Because when I read all those policy documents, I see that Sinn Féin supports the suckler, the lamb, the tillage, the horticulture schemes, support for generational renewal, forgotten farmers, nature restoration. Yeah. You're against the Mercosur trade deal.
Very strongly, yeah.
Exactly the same position as the government.
Well, when you mentioned Mercosur, the government has been, I think, very wishy-washy on Mercosur, and I certainly don't see that they're saying that they're opposed to it in its present format, but, you know, they're not, I don't think, strong enough in respect of that. And as we can see, Europe is already ploughing ahead with that deal, and it is going to be very, very bad for Irish farmers.
Okay, but your position is broadly the same as theirs in so many different areas.
Their stated position and ours is broadly the same, but their stated position isn't something that they're actually following through on. And in a lot of other issues as well, particularly I think the things that government can have control over, Philip, the schemes that are out there, the schemes for environmental schemes, the schemes that many farmers depend on for to supplement their income. Acres is an example, and I know you've done a piece on your show recently about it, where, you know, farmers just can't get the payments, and they've kept up their side of the bargain. And and continuously, every time that government bring out new schemes, they have this kind of issues with them. And I think the one thing that we know government can have control over, they should be doing properly, and they should be ensuring that farmers get proper payments
for. But nobody is going to come here from the government and say that they support bad administration of the acre scheme, just like you. But the point is that on the policy of all of these schemes, you're all singing from exactly the same hymn sheet.
Well, I wouldn't say we're singing from exactly the same hymn sheet. I think we also need to be looking at diversification within farming. We need to be looking at getting farmers into a space where they can know what their future is. And one of the things we've looked at is a commission on the future of the family farm to ensure that farmers can see that in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years' time, particularly when they're looking at inheritance and at some younger person hopefully taking over the land, that there is a future for them, that they can have an income from it. And I don't think that's there in any of the other parties' manifestos.
In terms of the big ticket items that are affecting farming, again, I've been through all of your policy documents, and I'm just wondering how far away from the pulse is Sinn Féin's finger, because you don't mention in your policy documents nitrates derogation, you don't mention TB eradication, you don't mention the re-wetting of peat farmlands, you don't mention any of these things that are of real concern to farmers.
Well, there are some concern to farmers, of course, and we have been very strong, particularly on the issues of the re-wetting, on the nitrous derogation. It's clear.
Where, though? Not in your manifesto and not in anything you said in the Dáil.
I'm not in the position very long, in fairness, Philip, and I actually met with the IFA and with all the farm organisations around all of those issues and spoke to them about it. Like, the nitrous derogation is an interesting one, because the truth is, you know, there's a small number of farmers that are availing of it. They're mainly in land which is very good land and which can sequester carbon very well and which will produce grass and process it very well. And it is a reflection of the model of farming that we have in Ireland, which is free roaming cattle and grass-fed, all of those things, which is very, very good. And I think we need to be holding on to that as long as possible. And at the same time, we need to be protecting our watercourses.
You have been very quiet on what needs to be done to help farmers in reducing on-farm emissions. No mention in your election manifesto at all. Why is that?
On farm emissions. Well, the truth is that we have a lot of work to do in respect of that. And I think, as I say, what we're talking about here is we're talking about having lower intensity farming, higher biodiversity farming, and we need to see and ensure that we can do that in a way where farmers get a return for the public good that they do and the service they provide to the environment.
Okay, but
that's clear. And everything can't be in the manifesto, as you know, Philip.
Well, anywhere else on the website, I can't find any mention of this. Because, look, I mean, as you know, agriculture is still the biggest source of emissions.
Absolutely.
In the country.
It's one of our major industries.
We are legally obliged now to reduce them by 25%. And so far, we have only achieved 3% of that. 5 years, just five years to do the other 22%. Is that not a source of concern for Sinn Féin? Why are you not hammering the government on that?
Of course it is. It's a source of concern for everybody, and it's particularly a source of concern for farmers. farmers that are trying to make an income and trying to make a living, and find that in a lot of cases they are the ones that have been, if you like, pinned to the wall as being the bad guys in respect of all of this. And I don't think that's fair in a lot of cases, because farmers are generally trying to do their best. The custodians, and you know that, Philip, you've been out and meeting farmers, you know what
yeah,
they're
and
doing.
We see
and
the progressive
they're innovative
farmers
and they're progressive.
Absolutely, are making huge leaps and bounds here. But why are you not hammering the government on supports for everybody else to actually make that big quantum leap?
But we are. We are making support. And as you know, the Dáil is only up and running in a couple of weeks, and we haven't even got committees going yet. So we're in the very early stages of all of that, Philip.
I think that one of the interesting things about things this is that, all things being equal, your next chance of being in government comes in 2030. And that is the point at which failure to meet those targets is going to reap a whirlwind of perhaps as much as 20 billion euro in yeah. fines and carbon yeah. credits that we have to buy. Is that something that you are happy about inheriting?
Absolutely not. We don't want anyone to fail in respect of that. We need to see.
So it makes the case, does it not?
It makes the case
for you providing really vigorous opposition now.
Yes, of course. And we are doing that, and we'll continue to do that into the future. And at the same time, we understand that we have to work in cooperation with everybody. We have to understand that farmers have an awful lot of work to do, but so has everybody else in society. You know, it's not all on the farming community, but the farming community can have a huge, if you like, positive role in respect of all of this, and can do an awful lot to ensure that we can both absorb and lock away our carbon for our building future. We need to build an awful lot of houses in this country. We need to have, you know, new methods of technology which will do that, and farming can provide some of the raw materials and resources for that as well.
Martin Kenny, look forward very much to talking to you over the course of the next 5 years. All things being equal, of course, I'm presuming you don't end up in government before then. Thank you very much.
Well, you never know. Things are dicey enough.
No, you do never know, do you? Coming up after the break, can we vaccinate for avian flu?
Email countrywide at rte.ie.
Connor has texted on 0870 32 32 32 in relation to me welcoming the start of spring today. He says, Philip, on this day 7 years ago, i.e. the 1st of March 2018, Ireland was visited by the beast from the east. Yeah. You know what? You're absolutely right. There are perhaps a few wrinkles in my view of spring that have to be ironed out. Nervous time for poultry producers once again. Avian flu in Northern Ireland has led to over 100,000 birds being culled there. No cases yet this side of the border in commercial flocks, but 5 cases in wild birds have been identified since the start of the year. So it is a threat that is hanging quite precariously over the heads of anyone producing eggs or chickens. What though if you could vaccinate poultry against avian flu? Well, you can. They do it quite successfully in China. And the French have recently taken the decision to vaccinate their duck flocks. So this morning I want to explore if it would be a workable solution here. What would it cost? Would we be able to sell vaccinated eggs and chicken meat abroad? All questions which hopefully Gerald Barry, Professor of Virology at UCD Vet School, can help us with. But I want to go first to Linda Douglas in Wicklow, a free-range egg producer. Now, there was a buzzard in Wicklow infected with the virus that is the most recent wild bird to have tested positive. What, I wondered, had this done to her anxiety levels?
Yes, my stress levels went up because nobody likes to hear of an infected bird anywhere in the area around where you have a poultry site, especially free-range hens that is out. So alarm bells were ringing. I have just under 5,000 hens here.
Presumably, yeah, so. Since the housing order, they can't actually be free-range, can they?
They can't be free-range. They can be everything else apart from out grazing.
Okay, so that's 12 days now or 13 days that they have been in. What has that been like? Is it much extra work for you?
It's not. It's not much extra work. In any of your big hen houses now, you have their laying area, you have their eating area, you have their water area, but you also have a veranda, which is a big area. It's full of sand. So they still can come down, do their dust bathing, flicker their sand about, do their scratching, but they just can't get out and graze, okay. So they can't go outside.
So all of those natural behaviours that you'd like to see them exhibiting, they're still able to do them for the most part, are they?
For the most part, yes. So they're not under stress. Yes, they'd love to get out. They can look out, but they just can't step out.
And how does it impact your business? I mean, are you allowed to call the eggs free range anymore?
Yes, we are, yes. They had changed that rule last year. And as far as I'm concerned, I think it's... We should never have been putting a label on our boxes because it's an extra cost. But they are free-range birds. They're still eating their free-range ration. It's just that they couldn't get out for that length of time.
If you were offered a vaccination, similar to the one that the Chinese are using and now that the French are using, if you were offered that opportunity to vaccinate your hens against avian influenza, would you take it?
Yes, I would, yes. I totally think... We need to be going down the road of vaccines because I don't think this is going to go away. I mean, in America, it's devastating. The amount of dead birds is unreal. I think Australia is very impacted at the moment. So I totally think we should be going down the road of vaccinating young chicks so that this can't happen because it's devastating when it happens.
Could be a very significant cost increase, Linda. I mean, in Britain, I heard that they were estimating it might be 50 pence sterling a bird.
Yes, so that would be topping up the price of your pullet when it's coming in. Yes.
Would it put it beyond reach?
No, I suppose it wouldn't, but you would have to sit down and do out your figures like anything else.
So from your point of view, a vaccination is definitely something worth taking a look at.
Yes, it is. Totally.
Linda Douglas, Ballinarin Free Range Eggs there. And listening to her is Professor of Virology in UCD Vet School, Dr. Gerald Barry. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning, Philip.
What has been the Chinese experience of vaccinating against H5N1?
The Chinese reports have been very positive for the most part, both through their kind of media and official kind of government statements, but also through kind of many scientific publications that have come out. In general, it's been very positive. The number of outbreaks has reduced dramatically, and economically, their poultry industry has increased output, and so is more economically viable, I suppose, and potentially profitable. So overall, it's been a very positive experience that China have reported.
How do they do it? Where, I mean, Linda only has 5,000 birds, but there'd be many commercial operators who would have tens of thousands of birds. How do you actually physically administer the vaccination?
Yeah, so this is one of the challenges of the current vaccine that's available. For a lot of vaccines for chickens, you can put the vaccine in the water or you can kind of spray a mist over the chickens. But with the current influenza vaccine, it has to be administered to each individual bird intramuscularly, a bit like we would get a vaccine, I suppose, in the arm or something like that. So it's quite labour intensive. They tend to do it in hatcheries for the most part, but in some cases they'll give a second shot at about 5 or 6 weeks old. So it can be done relatively quickly. And of course, people become very efficient at it, but there is a labour intensive element to it.
And do these vaccines stop the spread of the disease or do they just suppress the symptoms so that the birds don't get sick when they contract it?
Yeah, so this is one of the key things. I think you don't get sterilising immunity with current vaccines against avian influenza in chickens, which means that it will reduce dramatically the likelihood of the chickens becoming infected. It will reduce the likelihood of them, if they do become infected, passing it on to other chickens or people. And also it'll reduce the clinical signs. So the animals don't get as sick. But importantly, the animals still can get infected and they still can pass it on. Just the chances of each of those things happening is reduced.
Okay. When you vaccinate anything, you're forcing the virus that you're targeting to get around that vaccination. How worried would you be about unintended consequences of doing this?
Yeah, one of the risks with any vaccine is that you're essentially creating a barrier that you're asking the virus to overcome. And what that barrier is doing is it's driving the virus to evolve. And any vaccine will do this against any virus. If you create a barrier to it, you're driving that virus to evolve. And the concern with a vaccine that doesn't stop infection, that doesn't stop transmission, is that you're creating that barrier and you're effectively saying to the virus, right, have a go. Have a go at getting around us. And with something like the flu, that virus is very adept at evolving rapidly. And so we know already from the Chinese experience that versions of the virus have evolved and emerged that have resistance to the vaccine. And we see that in humans as well with flu. It's why we have to get our annual flu vaccine. The virus evolves quite rapidly against whatever vaccine we're using in a particular year. And so the vaccine has to be updated to try and kind of keep pace with that evolution that's happening.
Okay. I would have thought that there were trade implications to vaccinating your flocks that would disqualify you from exporting. Obviously, that doesn't seem to be a concern in France, where they've started vaccinating their ducks.
Yeah, and it has affected some trade routes, and some countries have said no. But for the most part, I think countries are still accepting meat and meat products from France. The concern would be that if you have a chicken that is vaccinated but becomes infected, that clinically they may look well, but they may still be infected and potentially transmitting the virus. And that virus may also be carried potentially on the meat, for example. And so the concern from a country's point of view is if you're importing that product, are you potentially importing the virus as well? And so that's why some countries are a little bit nervous about the idea of importing from countries that are vaccinating their animals. But if you put the proper surveillance programs in place, then those concerns should be alleviated. And I think if it becomes a more widespread use technique, particularly in Europe, then I think countries are able to put and should be able to put policies in place that will reduce those concerns.
If indeed that figure that I heard from the UK of 50 pence sterling per bird per jab is correct, and you have people who have 30, 40, 50,000 birds in their units, that's obviously a prohibitive cost. Do you think that the current regime of biosecurity checks and housing birds would be sufficient if that is deemed to be too expensive to vaccinate?
I think biosecurity has to be the first port of call, regardless of vaccination, nearly. And I think probably there's a body of work that needs to be done there to improve things again. I mean, I think poultry farms, for the most part, are incredibly conscious of biosecurity and are in general very good at that. But of course, there's always gaps that can be improved on. And I think probably that's something that needs to be revisited and potentially investment both from the industry and potentially government as well in bringing up those biosecurity standards, bringing up the education levels and understanding about how the virus gets onto farms can be improved. And I think regardless of whether we bring in a vaccine or not, that biosecurity level has to be maintained at a really high level. And but I think the beauty of a vaccine is it would just create that extra layer of protection and reassurance probably for farmers.
From an animal husbandry point of view, do you have any concerns about having to house these animals now that were accustomed to being outside?
I think that's always a concern with how animals are treated and housed, and particularly in intensive farming industries, how the birds are managed. I think in scenarios where birds are typically kept outdoors and then are being brought back in, it isn't an ideal scenario, of course, from a welfare point of view, if birds are used to something and that is changed. But as was described in the piece earlier, I think if farmers are managing their animals well, then that can be handled appropriately. And you would hope that the barns are designed in such a way with appropriate space with welfare in mind, such that because this is such a common thing now, that farmers should be used to it and should be able to manage it appropriately.
Indeed. Dr. Gerald Barry, thank you very much. Very interesting stuff indeed. Professor of Virology in UCD Vet School there. One of the most moving interviews that we've had in Countrywide last year was with Catherine O'Leary, she of the columns in Irish Country Living, the Farmer's Journal, that document the highs and the lows of life on a busy dairy farm surrounded by a large family. Well, last year, Brenda visited her and the family on the farm in Cork outside Blarney, and she was recuperating from successful cancer treatment. Well, I'm terribly sorry to say that since then, Catherine has had some news that has cast everything in a different light. But as you will hear, when Brenda dropped in again this week, Catherine is undimmed and unbowed.
Nothing in that part, right? We're going to feed the calves in pen two, aren't we?
Yep, sure.
What's the first milk called that the cow gives for the calf?
colostrum.
Isn't that a big word? Yeah. Ricky yeah. has his own buckets here.
Buckets?
Yeah.
We put two scoops in each bucket.
And is this one of your favourite things to do with Granny?
Yep, because I get to spend extra time.
And tell me this, will you tell her the important bit? Do you get anything for your work?
I get money for my work.
Okay, baby girls, come on. Come on, baby girls. They're always my baby girls. Come on, good girls.
I know why you've great fun with him. Mm. Like, seriously, he's just a tonic.
He is an absolute tonic, Ricky is. He said to me last week, Granny, you know, you don't know everything. So he comes out with those wonderful statements.
It's just over a year since we chatted. Was it April or May that it all happened again, the cancer reappeared?
Yeah, it was about April. I was, as you saw then, Brenda, I was in wonderful form. Yeah. I was really well. I had plenty of energy. I was here in the calf shed loving every minute of it. And I was cancer free. And then I went for my check scan. I am checked every 3 months. And Dr. Deirdre O'Mahony is my consultant. She is the most wonderful lady. And, oh, there was just something about that day. She had papers. She never has papers on her desk when you go in. Everything is clear. But this day, there was a lot of paper and so on. And she turned and she said, look, of course Tim was with me. She said, Catherine, it's back. It's across your lungs. And she started to count and show us, you know, and they call them nodules, which are baby tumours, really. And she said, 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, and 1, you know. So it was everywhere across my lungs, so nothing could be done. So she said, look, I know I have a treatment in mind for you, and we will start that. And what we want to do is stabilise you and give you quality of life and so on. And of course, Brenda, I said, how long have I got? She said, the median is 2.5 years. Now, that was shocking, absolutely shocking. And to have to call all the gang together again and to just tell them that kind of news. Sure, we cried for a month. You know, we cried for a month trying to get our heads around this new bombshell. If you thought enough about the chemotherapy and where you're at and the fact that you're going to be on chemotherapy until the end of your life and the fact that you don't know how long that is going to be. It could be short, it could be long or whatever. I was driving myself crazy. You would wake up and, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I would be frantic, thinking thoughts about death that you don't need to be thinking about and so on. But one day I was inside going in for my pre-assessment. And there's the most gorgeous girl, Eileen is her name, and she's the receptionist there. She said, hello, Catherine, how are you? Are you here for your spa treatment? And I took a double take. I kind of, was she making a joke or what? And she saw my reaction and she said, well, there's a lady comes in here, she said, and she calls it her spa treatment. And I thought to myself, my God, there is a mindset to have. Number one, I'm inside in the hospital for 2 days getting my treatment. I'm not sick until the treatment hits, maybe a couple of days later. I'm in a nice room. I have a nice bed. I can have my music. I can have my oils. My sister comes in and does reflexology with me to put me asleep. A friend can call. I have a particular friend, Siobhan, comes in and chats with me, and Tim might come in the evening or whatever. And I just thought, isn't that the way forward? Because before chemotherapy, the day or two before, Brenda, I'd be so cranky and cross. Oh, I have to do this again, and this is going to be this way for the rest of my life. But this has changed me.
Can we give a shout out to Eileen on reception?
Absolutely, we can. We can indeed. And she'd be probably most embarrassed.
Yes, I hope so.
Yes, yes.
Catherine, the readers, your friends, everybody is probably offering you advice, trying to help you through it.
People offer all sorts of kind of help. One thing that has happened to me, Brenda, that worries me a small bit, and that is 4 or 5 people have offered to have me healed, as in healers themselves or take me to a healer. And I have said no. And the reason I have said no is, first of all, it unnerves me a small bit. And secondly, and most importantly, I have the most wonderful consultant
Dr. Deirdre O'Mahony and her team. And my trust is in them. That is why I have to say no to people who mean really well when they offer me something like healing. But I just can't go there.
Yeah. Ricky, are all the calves fed now?
Yep.
Time to go home.
So we're going for our lunch. Brenda, this is Tim here. Oh,
okay. How are you, Tim?
I'm well, thank
you. My better half. I couldn't manage without him. I mean, he has become an excellent cook. It's a pity.
Does that starve?
It's a pity I didn't know it years ago. I'll leave you have a chat, and Ricky and I are going to go and make lunch. Bye, Ricky.
We'll
walk away home, and we'll see you at home. Okay, let's go.
Boil the kettle.
She said very strong things about you, Tim. I bet you won't acknowledge how good you've been to her.
I met Catherine when we were 17. And we've been together since, you know, so that's nearly 50 years now. So we've all the corners knocked off each other a long time ago. I think the cancer changes your perspective. You go from a place where, before Catherine's cancer, and we were looking forward to retirement, you know, we have a son farming with us now, so the progression was happening and the changeover was happening and we were looking forward to more free time, I suppose, and certainly for me that included an opportunity to do a good bit of travel because I love travelling. That has changed now because of the chemotherapy, especially. We're fairly tethered to the hospital. That's sad. That's sad.
So you've known Catherine as the love of your life. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Say that, yeah. For nearly
half. You know, I don't know which arm it is, but just one half of us. Anyhow. And I'm the same to her, you know, so. Mm. And we've always been able to lean on each other, dealing with issues. And I find that a bit hard now. It's very hard to talk to Catherine about the disease on an ongoing basis because she doesn't need the constant reminder or constant emphasis on it. And I miss that ability, or I miss that capacity to just trash out an issue. We always trashed it out together, and I miss that. Mm. So now we'll go for lunch.
That's some sight.
Isn't that some sight, yeah. We're looking out just across from the living room. We're out in the front lawn looking across. Ballincollig is over the hill and we can see all our neighbours all along. But look, here are the cows going out the passage off to grass. And that's the real side of spring when you see the daffodils and the spring roses and they're all coming along and the girls are going to grass. They love spring and they just take off.
Why do you love this beautiful sight we're looking at?
Oh, I suppose number one, it's home, and it has been home for we're married here 42 years, and it's ever changing, Brenda. Every time you look at it, it's different. The fog comes up there in the morning, it rolls up and snow white, and it rolls up literally along where the cows are going on up there over the hill. It's just beautiful. It's serene, and as you know, my bedroom's just up there, so that's my view in good times and bad times.
Well, now, this is a very full kitchen table,
isn't
Catherine?
Fabulous. Yeah. Yeah, it's lovely to have the kitchen table full like this with them all around it. My four adult children are here, Julie and Dermot and Philip and Colm. And Aileen, Philip's wife, is here as well, the mother of this most gorgeous little bundle inside here in my arms. This is Katie Margaret O'Leary, my youngest grandchild. And here is Ricky, my oldest grandchild.
Hi, Ricky.
Hi.
Fresh from the calf shed. Yeah.
And where is Peter, my in the middle grandchild? He has the dustpan and the brush and he's cleaning up. Tim is sitting down there at the head of the table.
Ignored as usual.
There's another thing on the table. It's a graduation picture.
This year, Dermot graduated from UCC. He got a certificate in disability inclusive practice. Isn't that right, Dermot?
Exactly.
Congratulations, Dermot. Well done.
Thank you very much.
And look at your picture. It's very nice.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I look very handsome.
You do.
Except for my dad.
Yeah.
My mother looks beautiful.
And you look very well as well.
Oh, thank you.
Hello, Baba. And here we are on cue. Katie says, I want my dinner. Yeah? Will you wait for another minute? You will? I really want to see her grow, Brenda. You know, I'm not going to lie. I want to see them grow. I want to see them develop. And I want to be able to tell them my stories and Tim's stories about our families and so on, because I think that's the role of great grandparents, really, you know, instilling all that lovely stuff into them. So, yeah, so that's, I mean, that's life, isn't it? It sums it up. We never know what's around the corner. But I think when we get bad news or something bad happens, my advice to people is to just stop and stop thinking. Stop overthinking what might happen, what's going to happen, or even what you're being told is going to happen, because nobody really knows. And I think Tim and I became experts at that when Julie was diagnosed with her disability, when Dermot arrived with a lot of medical issues and Down syndrome. If we weren't able to stop the bad thoughts, I don't think we would have survived. So you have to stop and you have to think about today and get on with tomorrow. Try and fit that bad news into your life in a place, but let life go on. Why be miserable if you can be happy? It's the only way.
Three-week-old baby Katie there, Catherine O'Leary's granddaughter. She will incidentally never know how close she came to being kidnapped by Brenda Donoghue. But that is quite a message to set us up for the weekend, I think. Stop overthinking. Life is for living. Why be miserable if you have the opportunity to be happy? Today's programme was put to air with the help of Ruth Kennington, Ina Dacher and Eileen Herron. Playback is on the way. Don't forget, Here to the Ground on Thursday on RT1 at 7:30. Do go out there and live this weekend.